Okay, we're starting here on the two dots at the bottom of Yud Amud Bet with the Shita of Rabbi Shimon in the Mishnah. We know that is ready when we read the Mishnah that Rabbi Shimon's Shita is very difficult because he says, Af ilu ksherim, which means even gitei nashim v'shichruei avadim are ksherim, lahuzkru azman shenasu behejot. The only problem is when they're done by lay people, not when they're done inside of the court system, which means here that you have a get or Shichrur Avadim that is done inside of a non-Jewish court, and it's fine, and you have non-Jewish signatories to the document, and it's fine. How could that be? How could that possibly be a kosher get? And that's what the Gemara asks. V'hav lav b'nei kritut ninu. These individuals are not part of the world of Kiddushin and Gerushin, which is a requirement. In order to be an aid in these situations, you have to be someone who is Shayach, who is relevant within the world of Gitin and Kiddushin. And over here, you don't have that. These individuals are akum, and the akum are not relevant in those areas, so they can't sign. Tosafot already points out that that's not the only problem that we have here. Forget about that they aren't shayach, because they're not relevant to the world of kritut, and then they can't testify the gabei, gitin, or kiddushin, but they're, even more importantly, they fail fundamentally because they're not edim. They're not kasher edim. We have problems of lishma, problems of shlichut. There are plenty of reasons here why you could dismiss them. Tosafot just leaves it as if, okay, it's a question. Others, like the Ramban, say that that's subsumed under halav b'nei kritut ninu. It's just almost like v'chule, or it's a general header to say there are problems here with these edim, fundamental problems with these edim, for numerous reasons. And therefore, how could he possibly suggest that this get, or this shichur avadim, is kasher? The Gemara dashes other places with regards to an Eved Knani, Parsha at the end of Sefer Vayikra, that there are certain rules. First of all, Akum cannot own a Jew as property. He can own him as equivalent of an Eved Ivri, which is the same way that a Jew can own another Jew, which is that you have a leasehold in the individual, you do not have ownership in them. On the other hand, a Jew can own a Knani as property, and physical property, and then you own the individual. There, the Gemara is midayek, that it's only true of a Jew's relationship towards a Knani. But a Knani's relationship to another Knani is only that of a leasehold. So they don't have the same dinim or relationship. That's number one. Number two is, there is a gzer shavo, a la'ala, which is that whatever is true by Gerushin is true by Shechurei Avadim. And so therefore, being disqualified by Shitei Nashim also disqualify you by Shechurei Avadim. Am Rabbi Zera, Yarad Rabbi Shimon l'shitato shel Rabbi Elazar. So again, we saw this earlier. This presents the problem with explaining the Tanakhama as well that we saw earlier, which is that Rabbi Shimon subscribes to the shita of Rabbi Elazar. Damar edei misira karte. The gerushin are made effective by the edei misira. So the assumption here is that the kiyum haget was done in front of two edim Yisraelim. It's just that it was done in a secular court. It has signatories that are non-Jewish, but that doesn't change the fact that the get was given in front of two Edim Ksherim Yisraelim. Again, we saw earlier that that presents a problem, because then the Gemara earlier tried to explain the Tanakhama in the Shita of Rabbi Elazar. There the Gemara says, the Nafkamina Shemot HaMufakim. Over here, Rashi asked yesterday, why is it that the Gemara doesn't use that answer over here, that it's Rabbi Elazar? Rashi says that was a Shinuya Dechika, that was a difficult answer. We spoke about Tosafot's approach as to why the Gemara doesn't do that. But here, the Gemara does say that Rabbi Shimon's Shita must be following Rabbi Elazar's Shita, because otherwise, there's no other way to explain how he could possibly make a get Nashim or Shechurei Avadim Kasher when you have non-Jewish signatories who are clearly problematic, and it's done inside of a secular court. So, V'hamar Rabbi Ava Mode Rabbi Elazar B'mzuaf Mitucho Shepasul. Then we already established that even Rabbi Elazar agrees if the integrity of the document is compromised because of something that's written in it, even if you have Edim Sira, that's going to ruin the document. And over here, you have non-Jewish edim signed on the document, and that's going to make it mizuyaf mitocho. It says, achama iskinan b'shemot muvchakim. That here we're dealing with names that are obviously non-Jewish names, that Jews don't go around using these names, and therefore we're not going to rely on these individuals as the edim misira. There's no question or mistake that is going to be made here, that we're going to rely on these individuals as the Eidei Mesira, because it's going to be clear that they are non-Jewish signatories to this get. So it turns out to be, interestingly, almost counterintuitive, which is that when you know for sure that they're Akum, then the document is not Muzuyaf Mitocho, because then it's obvious that they were not the Eidei Mesira, and doesn't present you with a problem. And then when there are names that were uncertain, they could be Jewish names, it could be non-Jewish names, then it is Mizuyaf Mitocho, because then you might rely on those Eidim who are the Eidei Chatima to be the Eidei Mesira as well. And that is improper. And so that would be classified as Mizuyaf Mitocho. It's interesting, Rashi, back on Daf Tet, said this, that according to the Shita of Rabbi Lazar and Rabbi Shimon here, the question is whether it's Mizuyaf Mitocho or not Mizuyaf Mitocho. Other Rishonim, like Tosafot over there, explained that it's a gzeira. It's much more what it sounds like, which is, if it's obviously Akum, there's no reason to make a gzeira. On the other hand, if they are quite names that we're not sure about, then there's a reason to make a gzeira, she'emot she'inam mufakim, that they might rely on them as Eidei Mesira. And so they view it as a gzeira, not as an issue of Mizuyaf Mitocho, although the fact that the Gemara starts with that question is indicative more along the lines of Rashi Shita that we're talking about here, an issue of Mizuyaf Mitocho. The Gemara before said that's the nafkamina between Rabbi Shimon and the Tanakhama. Rabbi Shimon says that only by Shemot She'enum Nivhakim, either according to Rashi, do we say Mizuyaf Mitocho, according to the Baitosa, we have Gzeira. The Tanakhama says that we're Gozer Shemot Mufkakim Alto Shemot She'enum Nivhakim. That was actually the difference between them. And that's what we ended off yesterday's Gemara with, the question as to why the Gemara doesn't use that answer here. Over here, the Gemara uses the answer, Dina Machut Dina, or Chut Miki Gedei Nashim, to solve the problem of the Tanakhama, rather than saying that he holds like Rabbi Elazar as well. So Gemara says, Heichi Dami Shemot Mufkakim. What are examples of obviously non-Jewish names? Amar Papa Kagon, Hormiz V'Abudina, Bar Shibtai, Bar Kidri, Ubati, Venakim Una. So these are names that are utilized only by non-Jews and not by Jews. The question is, there are plenty of names that you could have given as examples. What are so special? What are so unique about these names? In all the likelihood, you could speculate here. If you look down the side on the left side, you can see there's a Tosafot for nearly every one of these names here. And Tosafot is making a fine distinction between other places where we find Jewish names that are similar to this, and these are non-Jewish names. The reason that these names might have been used is because there are Jewish names that are very similar, and despite that, Rav Papa is telling you these are Shemot Mufkakim. So you can see here, our Girsa in the Gemara is Hormiz. If you look in Tosfot on the top, he says, Hormin, Ben Nun, Garas Rabbeinu Tam. The Hormin, who shame Satan Veshed. Hormin is the name of a Satan and a Shade. He's brought down in the stories in Baba Batra of Rabbi Bar Chanon, about Hormiz B'Zayin Hu L'Shevach. That's a nice name. That's a praiseworthy name. Rashi Garis Tavayu B'Zayin. Rashi writes both of them with a Zayin. If you look next on the next one, Abu Dina, Akol Shem Echad. That's all one name. Abu Dina, the way the Tosafot has it, seems like it's Abu Dina, but the way we have an argument, it's Abu Dina. Akol Shem Echad. The Abu Shem Yisrael. Because Abu is a Shem Yisrael. So again, there's this fine distinction between Abu, which is a Jewish name, and Abu Dina or Abu Dina, which is not. Again, next one. Shibtai, which is Bar Shibtai. Garsinan. Deshavtai, Shem Yisrael, who become a Mekamot. All of Shibtai, who Ruach Ra. Shibtai is like a evil spirit. So again, fine distinction between whether it's Shabti or Shabbati or Shabbatai versus Shibtai, which is one is a Jewish name, one's a non-Jewish. And then you have here Ubati, Garsinan. Here it's a Bati or Batbatai, because you look, Tosfot puts an Aleph in there. Garsinan, Debati, Shem Yisrael. Because without an Aleph, it's a Shem Yisrael. So that might exactly be what the Gemara is after over here. It's picking names that are very close to Jewish names and saying, despite the fact that they are close to Jewish names that we know of, these are Shemot Mufhakim. These are definitely non-Jewish names. Aval, Shemot, She'ina Mufhakim. Names that are not clearly non-Jewish names, my, what's the din? Lo. In that case, we would not utilize them. So Gemara asks, Ihochi, if that's the case, the Satani Sefa Luhu's crew, Alabizman Shanasub Hejolt, then Rabbi Shimon says the only time you run into a problem is when the documents are done by lay people or under the auspices of lay people. Liflog v'litnei b'dida. You could have made a finer distinction and just said, b'meid v'r mamurim. When is it true that in erkaot, in the court system, that these are considered to be good documents, gitei nashim shechrei abadim, b'shemot mufchakim. Aval shemot she'enim mufchakim lo. That would be the low side of it. Don't say that it's only true in professional courts. It's not true with lay people. You can make a finer distinction. Even within the professional courts, there's a difference between whether the names are obviously non-Jewish names or they're names that could be Jewish names. That would have been a better distinction then based on what you're suggesting over here. Mar says, Hachinami Kamar. That's exactly what it means. When is that true? Bishemot Mufakim. That is when the names are obviously non-Jewish names. When you have names that are not obviously non-Jewish names, they're the equivalent of documents that are done outside of the court system by lay people. Upsulim. And they are problematic. As Rashi says over here. Avo shemot she'inu mufakim nasu kish'arei shtarot shel mecher nasu behejotot. They are the equivalent of any other document that is done by lay people below erkaot, without a court system. Dehanu vadai psile. Those are definitely pasul. Delo kapte aurei nafshayu v'chatmei shikra. Because they don't worry about purging themselves. They don't worry about lying. Here, the whole reason that we say that this works is the court system has a certain amount of integrity to it, and it wants to maintain that integrity. Now, we did say yesterday, in the Rambam, in the Perush Mishnayot, that you have to know that it's a system with integrity. You have to know that it's a system that they cannot be bribed or misled, that they are people, both in terms of the Edim and the Shuftim, who generally would tell the truth and are Ne'eman. But the whole concept revolves around this idea that the institution wants to maintain integrity and authority. On the other hand, when you deal with lay people, they have no incentive not to lie, or they have no incentive, even if they're caught and they're found that they signed on something that wasn't real, the repercussions are really not so severe because they're not implicating a whole institution or taking down the authority of a whole institution. And therefore, they don't have the imta, they don't have the fear of just signing on something even though it's not true. So what the Gemara is suggesting over here, basically what Rashi says is, when I'm telling you in the Mishnah that when you do it with lay people, obviously the problem with lay people is even with other shtarot. That's not just a problem for Gitei Nashim and Shechrei Abadim. That's a problem even for regular shtarot. Because the whole believability of these individuals, the nemanut of these individuals, is compromised because there's no overarching impetus for them to tell the truth. People tell the truth either because they're nemanim, because they are people who are trustworthy, or they tell the truth because they fear. They have some other impetus that's causing them to tell the truth. They're afraid of punishment. They're afraid of the government. Or they're an institution that wants to maintain integrity, and therefore they're afraid of losing that integrity, and therefore they tell the truth. These factors are used with regards to Rav Moshe Feinstein's Heter Legabei Chalav Akum in countries where there is an institution that ensures the quality of the milk, like the FDA in the U.S., there is this concept of imta there because they have a job and they want to maintain the integrity of the institution of the FDA. They're not going to lie because if they got caught lying, first of all, the people who lied are all going to get fired, but it also compromised the FDA as a whole. There is this concept of imta that exists. So what Rashi suggests over here is that the lack of an impetus to tell the truth is a problem not only in Gitei Nashim Shechrei Avadim, but it's a problem for any shtar. And because when you don't have erkaot, and you don't have imta or nemanut, then these individuals would psulim even by shar shtarot. And that's what it means. When behedyotot, it means that just like any shtar is a problem by hedyotot, so too, gitei nashim and shechrei avadim with shemot she'inu mufakim are just like that. They're just as problematic for different reasons. The problem of hedyotot, this problem is that we can't believe them. The problem by Shemot Shein Muvakim is not that we can't believe them, just that we have a problem that they might get mixed up and we might come to believe them, which is we might believe that they're the Edei Mesira. Tosfot over here asks, why doesn't the Gemara ask a much more fundamental question? The Gemara says, Liflog v'litna b'dida. V'im tomar, adarabba, tikshe le gufa de matnitan. Lama paslu behejot? Why does the Mishnah say that hejot is a problem? Came to ikay de misira b'shemot mufakim. If you set up the Mishnah now to say that the case here is a case where they're signed by non-Jewish edim, but they're obviously non-Jewish edim, and they have to be then edim misira Yisrael. If that's the situation in which it's done in the court system, then why by hejot is a problem either? Gitein Hashem Yishechu Avadim, we don't need nemanut in the sense of truth-telling, because the get, the whole kiyuma get, is not being done by the edei chatima. It's all being done by the edei misira. And based on the case that you set up now, there are edei misira, because these are obviously non-Jewish edim, and they're not going to make the get into a good get. So Tosfot says, then why is hejot pasul in this instance? If edei misira can overcome that problem by erkot, they should be able to overcome the problem by hejotot as well. First of all, the way the Mishnah is written, it says Rabbi Shumar af iluk sherim, which makes it sound like he's talking about gitei nashim and shichrei avadim, and then the next line is about the same documents. Rashi just explained that that's not the case, that the next line is talking about shteri hejotot. And therefore, Rashi really, in a sense, solves the problem by saying that the next line is not talking about gitei nashim and shichrei avadim, it's talking about shteri hejotot. Problem is that the next line in the Gemara is ibaitema, is that that last line is talking about shterei hejotot, other shterot, not gitei nashim, which implies that the first answer thinks that it is speaking about gitei nashim. Ve'esh lamar, tegazrin hejot gitei nashim atushar shterot. Tosfot in the end says that that's exactly the problem. You're right. In Ochanami, it would work by hejotot, just like it works by erkot, because the edim sira are the ones that make it into a good get. But when you have lay people sign on the document, the whole thing was done in the context of lay people, we're afraid that gitei nashim will become similar to other shtarot, and people will make a mistake by other shtarot to say it's fine also, which there it's not. The pasle behejot, af be'edei misira. Even if you have edei misira, by a hejot, we don't do that. Dilma ati lachshir below edei misira. Because maybe you'll come to be makshir without edei misira, kamo be'er kaot. Even though that becomes, in essence, a gzera l'gzera, because you're saying that the whole problem why you can't use other shtarot by hejotot is because you might come to use the edim as not only edei chatimah, but edei misira. And now you're saying by gitei nashim, don't do it. Otu, you might mix them up with regular shtarot, which might cause something else. It's a gzera l'gzera. What you have to say is that it's a single gzera that encompasses all of hejotot. Basically what the Chachamim says is we don't want you involved in the world of lay people because there are a lot of mistakes that can happen within the world of hejotot. Must be under that general context of hejotot. That's the way the Balei Tosafot answer the question as to why the Gemara doesn't allow Gitei Nashim and Shechui Avdarim to work by Hejotot, even though it should have worked based on what we're saying until now. Whereas the Ramban believes that having Hejotot here might lead to a total failure in protocol, which is that the woman could convince the Dayanim, who are the Hejotot, or the Edim here to do what she wants, and since they don't know the laws well, and they don't understand what's supposed to happen, you could have a total breakdown in what is needed here in terms of the Edei Misira. So we don't trust any document that comes out of Hejotot for that reason, including Gitei Nashim, even though we know that they were Edei Misira. Rashi says that that line in the Mishnah is talking about Shtari Hejotot, and therefore he doesn't run into the problem. Because Ein Ochanami, maybe according to Rashi, Gitei Nashim and Shechui Avdim would be Kosherim, according to Rabbi Shimon, in the face of Hejotot. Because they don't rely on the Hejotot at all, they only rely on the Edei Misira. That's the way that Rashi reads it. Whereas the Ramban believes that it's problematic both for Shterei Mamon as well as Get Nashim, as we mentioned before in the sheet of the Ramban, that he thinks that anything done in front of Hejotot is problematic. But how could Rashi possibly explain that that last line is talking about Shterei Hejotot? The next line in the Gemara is V'ibaitema Seifa Atan the Gitei Mamon. That line in the last part of the Mishnah is talking about regular shtarot, Gitei Mamon, instead of Gitei Piturin. It's not talking about Get Isha or Shechrei Avadim, it's talking about regular shtarot. Didn't Rashi just explain the first answer as being regular shtarot? How about the second answer? V'achi Kamar, this is what it means. Lo Uskru Gitei Mamon de Psulim Ela Bezman Shenasu Be'ejot. Gitei Mamon are only problematic when they're done by lay people. So that seems to imply that the previous answer was not doing that, even though Rashi says it the same. Rashi solved the problem by saying, V'rabbanon kamrile. Rashi changed the authorship of the last line of the Mishnah. The Ibaitema is not, according to Rashi, changing what is being said, but rather, who is saying it? Before, we thought it was Rabbi Shimon saying it, that when it comes to hedjutot. Hedjutot here doesn't mean about gittin hashim shechavadim, it means regular shtarot. Regular shtarot that are done by lay people, even Rabbi Shimon agrees that those are problematic. And so just like those are problematic, so are gittim with names that are inam ufakim. That's the way Rashi reads the previous piece. Over here he says, now the Gemara says, Ibaitema, that last line of the Mishnah doesn't belong to Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon Omer, afelu shirim, period. Then, lo huskuru, elab is manchna subejot. That is going back on the Chachamim's position, which is that when they said, kol ashtarot, olim ber kochel of de chachavim, afel pishachot meim of de chachavim kshirim, on that, they say that's only true in her coat. That is not true by hedjotot. That's the way Rashi deals with it, and saying that the answer is the same either way, whether it's Rabbi Shimon or the Chachamim, it's a question of who said it. And so that you won't run into the problem that Tosfot runs into, which is, how could you say that Gitein Hashim, Shugriya, and Nadim are problematic by Hedjotot? There's nothing to be problematic there. It's Eidei Mesira, and that's the same as their coat. Tosfot says, okay, we'll have to say Gzeira Otu, and that's how he gets rid of the problem. Rashi doesn't run into the problem because he never explains that last line as referring to Gitein Hashim, Shugriya, and Nadim. So that's how Rashi gets out of the problem. Other Rishonim, again, raise the issue like Tosfot and give other answers to deal with it. But just the fundamental way of how to read the Mishnah precipitates the problem. If you think it's Rabbi Shimon's statement, then you have to explain the difference between the first answer and the second answer. Second answer implies that it's talking about shtere mamon, which means that the first answer is talking about gitin. And then once you do that, you have to explain why are gitin problematic if you have Eidei Mesira over here. So that's what Tosafot is dealing with. Rashi just fundamentally reads the Mishnah differently and says that last line, according to the second answer, is the sheet of the Chachamim. And then the sheet that before was Rabbi Shimon, they're saying the same thing. They're both saying Gitei Mamon, just a question of who's saying it. If it's the Chachamim saying it, then you have to ask on Rabbi Shimon why he didn't make a finer distinction, because he makes no distinction in the Mishnah. If it is Rabbi Shimon, then it says, Hachikamar, Shemot She'inam Ufakim is the equivalent of other Shtarot, not Gitei Nashim Shavavadim, Behejotot, which are Psalim according to Rabbi Shimon. And that's how Rashi reads it and solves that problem. Right, Tanya, we have a bright up. Amar Rabbi Elazar bi Rabbi Yosi, kach amar Rabbi Shimon chachamim. This is what Rabbi Shimon said to the chachamim b'tzidan. Lo nechleku Rabbi Akiva v'chachamim. Kiva and the chachamim did not argue. Now, as Rashi points out, Rabbi Kiva and the chachamim are the generation before them. They are Tanaim speaking, a generation after Rabbi Kiva and the chachamim. Rabbi Shimon is a Talmid of Rabbi Akiva. Lo nechleku Rabbi Akiva v'chachamim ashtarot sh'olim b'erkot sh'olim t'chachamim. Everybody across the board agrees that when you go into non-Jewish courts, it's fine, just like our Mishnah says. So here, as opposed to our Mishnah, which has Rabbi Shimon and the Chachamim arguing on this point, he says that they agree in the previous generation, even Gitein Hashim Shechrei Avadim are Ksherim when they go into the court system, basically the Shita of Rabbi Shimon and the Mishnah. Rabbi Shimon and the Mishnah says, my Shita is everybody's shita. Both the Chachamim and Rabbi Akiva say this. Lo nechloku, so where is their machloket? Ela bezman shenasu behejot. The only machloket is when they were done by lay people. Sh'Rabbi Akiva machshir, Chachamim poslim. Chutz migitei nashim shechrei avadim. So Rabbi Akiva is machshir, and the Chachamim say they're pasul with the exception of gitei nashim shechrei avadim. So first of all, this is Rabbi Shimon's shita in the Mishnah basically derives from his understanding here, which is that everybody agrees that when you're in the court system, all shtarot are fine. That means not only shtarei raya, but even shtarei kiyum, because we assume there were Eidei Mesira there, and everything is fine. The only problem is when you're dealing with lay people. When you're dealing with lay people, then Rabbi Akiva and the Chachamim argue. Rabbi Akiva says with lay people, they're fine. Chachamim poslim. The Chachamim say they're problematic. Chutz, Gitei Nashim Shechrei Avadim. They say also, you're right, regular documents are problematic. But Gitei Nashim and Shechrei Avadim are fine. Why are they fine? Because they are relying on Eidei Mesira. The Eidei Chatima have no bearing whatsoever here. And they don't need Nemanut. They don't need believability. There's only thing you need are the Eidei Mesira by the Get. That's the way that Rashi reads it. Whereas the Ramban believes that it's problematic both for Shterei Mamon as well as Get Nashim, as we mentioned before in the sheet of the Ramban, that he thinks that anything done in front of Hedjotot is problematic. Over here you have basically Rabbi Shimon Shita, which is that by Shemot HaMuvhakim, that Rabbi Shimon believes that even in Erkaot, those are considered kasher when they're obviously non-Jewish names. Because when they're obviously non-Jewish names, we're not going to rely on them to be the Eidei Mesira. We're going to know that they have to be Eidei Mesira Yisraelim. Otherwise, we know that the get is problematic. So now the Gemara says, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, Af Eluk Shirim, B'makom She'en Yisrael Chotmim. So he says, even those documents are clearly okay in places where Jews are not allowed to sign. In a place where the rules are that Jews may not sign on these documents. So since Jews in that city can't sign on the document, everybody knows that they are non-Jewish signatories and has the same, as you just said, the same impact as Shemota Muvchakim. Because if Jews can't sign, then the signatories are definitely non-Jewish. So it doesn't matter if their names look Jewish, don't look Jewish, whatever their names are, the fact that they signed is an indication they're not Jewish. And so therefore it gives you the same effect as Shemot HaMufakim. Aval, b'makom Shisrael chutmim, in a place where Jews are allowed to sign, lo. Then Rabbi Shimon Gamliel agrees, so then it's problematic. Makom she'en Yisrael chutmim, nami ligzor atu makom Shisrael chutmim. Just like we worry about Shemot HaMufakim, and we say that Shemot HaMufakim are problematic, because of Shemot She'enam Mufkakim. So let us say the same thing here. Let us say that cities that don't let Jews sign should be problematic because of cities where Jews are allowed to sign. So my says, Shema b'shma machlif, Atra b'atra lo machlif. The distinction is very different. When you're talking about names, names get confused. The difference between a clearly non-Jewish name and a non-Jewish name that could be a Jewish name could be very easily mixed up, especially if you're following Tosfot where there's an Aleph is the difference between the names, then it's very easily that names get could mixed up. And therefore, Shemot, She'enam Mufkakim could clearly get mixed up with Shemot HaMufkakim. And therefore, we're going to say, even though Shemot HaMufkakim is clearly not Jewish, we're not going to allow that to be a good document because of the fact that it could lead us to, by Shemot HaMufkakim Mufkakim, to rely on these names. But different cities, each city is its own world, in a sense. It has its own court system, own judicial system, and the people of the city know what's going on in the city. They're not going to get mixed up with another city that's somewhere else. This is in a time where, even if people traveled, it was less so, and you don't have heavy traffic between places as if everybody knows what's going on in every other city. The traffic is limited, and therefore, between cities, you're not going to get these huge mix-ups. What happens in this city happens in this city. What happens in that city happens in that city. People aren't going to get confused. If we allow it to go and happen in one city, that they'll confuse and do it in another city. So Rabbi Shimon Gamliel makes a distinction between cities that allow Jewish signatories versus cities that don't allow Jewish signatories. And in cities that they do allow Jewish signatories, he says that it's problematic, even if they're Shemot Mufakim, even if they are clearly non-Jewish names. So that leads to this Gemara's question, why does he worry about Shemot Mufakim and doesn't worry about the difference between the cities? And that leads to the answer that names get mixed up, cities don't get mixed up, and therefore Rabbi Shimon Gamliel has a slightly different view than Rabbi Shimon. Obviously, both of them are arguing on the Chachamim, just a question of where is it so obvious that these are non-Jews? According to Rabbi Shimon, it's when they have Shemot HaMufkakim. According to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, it's in a city where only non-Jews can sign, and since it's obvious, then we don't have to worry about people relying on these signatories, because they have to have Edei Mesira, and they'll know that they have to have Edei Mesira in those cases. Gemara says, Ravina Sava Lakshurei B'Knufiata D'Armai. So Ravina could thought to allow documents that were signed and brought together in these gatherings of the Armai and thought they'd be fine. Amalei Rafram, Erkotnan. The Mishnah says Erkot, which is a court system. So what Rashi says is that the Knufaya d'Armai was not a court system, was not a judicial system. Now whether that means that it was extra governmental, it was a court system, it just wasn't governmental court system, whether that means that it wasn't a court system at all. It was just a large gathering of people for whatever reason. He thought that maybe that was enough of a reason to allow the documents to go through because over there was a certain amount of integrity to this organization or this gathering that they wanted to maintain, and therefore they wouldn't let people lie or make up things within that context. Either way, Rafram says that doesn't work because it specifically says erkaot. We need an official judicial title because part and parcel with being a judge is the idea of impartiality, integrity, especially if they are government-sponsored judicial system, because then there's an authority and they would not want to compromise that authority or undermine that integrity. We know that from the Torah. The Torah specifically, when it talks about judges, it gives you all the tchunot, all the character traits that a judge has to have. And all of those are embedded inside of a court system, and that's why they're very particular about it being a court system and not just any organization or any gathering. So then the Gemara says, Amarova, Haishtora Parsa. This Persian document, the Masre Niale Ba'ape Sade Yisrael, that was given in front of Jewish witnesses, Magbim Be'im Ibnei Chared. You can use that as a valid document to collect from free and clear property. The Shtar HaParsa means it was written in Persian, and regular lay people, Persian lay people signed on it, but it was given in front of Jewish Edim. So you have now Edei Mesira. Because you have Edei Mesira, then we allow you to collect at least from Bnei Chari. We don't allow you to collect from encumbered property, because the whole reason one can go after encumbered property is if the person should have known better. He had to have known that there was a problem here. In our day, how do we know that someone had known better? He should have done a title search. He should have checked that someone else doesn't have a lien on the property, doesn't have ownership over the property. You do a title search, and then you do the transaction. You can't blame the guy anymore. He checked it out. There was no way you could have known. On the other hand, in their time, there was no title registry. You couldn't know. The only way people knew that something happened with the property, there was a lien on the property, or there was a transaction about a property, was if it was mifursam. It became a public, kaleitle. It gets spread around. And the way that kaleitle is when there are people signed on a document. The signatories to the document are what create the kala, which create the public noise. And so over here you have signatories that are Persian, and therefore that's not going to lead to a kaleitle. So therefore, for that reason, he's only allowed to collect from Bnei Chare. He's not allowed to collect from encumbered property. So where it says, V'halo yadeh de mikra. Let's start with a basic problem. The Jewish Edim that are seeing this don't know how to read Persian. So the fact is that these Jewish Edim don't know Persian. So how could they be testifying about what's in the document or what transpired over here? They can't even read what the document says. Where it says, Pitiyade, they say what they do know, what it was said in it. We saw that yesterday, that they can read it to them. Tosfot said yesterday, reading to them is a problem of Eid Mipi Eid. It's hearsay. We only allow that in certain instances where they don't have to testify about Maaseh, but only about the Ktav. Then you could say something. But here, the Eidim Sira are testifying not about the Ktav, they're testifying about the Maaseh. So it's a very different problem. And Tosfot even there and said you need two Eidim or someone who's Neman to read it. Here, how can they believe this guy who's reading it? They have no idea whether he's telling the truth or not. So therefore, it has to be Biyadeh. They know how to read Persian. Va'abinon Tav Shein Yochol Zayef. Don't we need in our contracts that are written where they cannot be forged? Veleka, and you don't have that here. That means that if someone was to erase something in the contract, it would be obvious that there was an erasure here or correction inside of the contract. If you don't have parchment that is used that can be told that it was changed, then a guy can just afterwards go erase the amount or add a zero in and change the amount in the document without anybody knowing about it. So the parchment that's used for documentation has to be parchment that if you erased on it, it would be obvious that it was an erasure. So over here, they're not using that type of paper. The Gemara says, ba'afitzan. There's a case where they put the afitzan, as Rashi knows over here, it's galls, whether that's gallnut juice that they're using, but it is, according to Rashi, something that darkens the parchment in the process of ibud, of tanning the leather, or the parchment. And in doing so, it leaves a blacker film on top of it or a darker color on top of it. And therefore, if you go to erase, you're not just going to erase the writing, you're also going to erase this blackness on top. And it'll be obvious that you changed it or you erased it, because the only way to erase it is to scrape it off. And by scraping it off, it's going to be obvious that you changed something that's there. So Gemara says, this is a document was written on such parchment that you could not forge or you cannot change the document afterwards. Tosfot over here speaks about a problem that comes up to Halacha all over the place. Here it's a smaller Tosfot. Many other places in Shas, it's a much larger Tosfot. Which is that the Rabbeinu Tam says, well then how can we write our Sifrei Torah, which are not Afitzan? Our Sifrei Torah are written on parchments that don't use the Afitzan. And over here it sounds like that you need to have Afitzan on any parchment that you use, whether it's for Shtarot, whether it's for Sifrei Stam. It's not for the same reason that it is here by contracts. Just, he points out, he says, Bekama Duchte, he says that it's obvious that the Gemara thinks that that's the case, that they need Afitzan. And he says, we clearly don't do that. In our preparation of the parchments for Stam, we do not put in Afitzan. So the Rabbeinu Tam answers like you, but Rabbeinu Tam, Sid Shalanu, Ki Ibur Afatzim Shalahem. He basically says that our limestone or lime that we put in it has the same impact as Afitzan on the parchment. Da'a Klafim Shalanu and Yocholim Tzdaif. Our parchments, if you erase on them, it's very clear that you erased. Yeah. And you can't erase without making it obvious. You can see that in a Sefer Torah. If they ever make a mistake and they have to erase it, you can see the markings of the erasure. That's how Rabbeinu Tam gets around it in saying that there is a necessity for Afitzan, but that necessity is covered by Sid. There are others in other places that argue on the Rabbeinu Tam who say that you don't need afitzan, and that's not an issue. The Rabbeinu Tam says you do need it, but it's replaced by another ingredient that we use today. Ragmar says, contracts or documents under the Jewish law, in their last line, have to re-summarize the major issues that were in the contract. So you have to, at the last line, you have to go back over that which is written in the shtar. There's two reasons for that. One is to know that's the end of the document, so people can't add things afterwards. And also is that the edim signature is right up against the major pieces of the contract, which is who's borrowing from whom, who's purchasing from whom. Their signatures are adjacent to that, and not that that's at the top of the document and they're signing at the bottom of the document. So for that reason, you have to repeat the last line in the document. So you don't have that here. Gemara says, okay, no problem. Again, the Gemara answers, they have it. Gemara says, so then they should be able to collect from encumbered property as well. You have a perfect shtar now. Everything that's about the shtar is done exactly like it would have done in a Jewish court. And you have Edei Mesira. What could be a deficit in the shtar? Gemara says, Le'kalo. This is what we discussed before, that if it cannot be publicized, because the publicization, as Rashi said, is done by the Sadeh Dechatimei Ashtara. It's done by the Edim that sign on the shtar. So here, they're the ones who make it into a public announcement or spread the word about the issue. And over here, they are Hedjotot. They're lay people, non-Jewish, Persian lay people. And that's not going to spread in the community. And so people are just not going to know that this is encumbered property. And therefore, he doesn't have a right with this to collect from encumbered property, only from B'nai Chare. And there are some Rishonim who suggest here that this is a case in front of Hedjotot. But had it happened in front of an Erkaot and a Beit Din, that would have a kol. I mean, that the kol either comes because you have Jewish Edim signed on the document, or it's done in a forum that's considered to be a formal and viable mechanism for making the contract into a valid contract, and therefore it has a kol as well when it's done in the Erkaot. And the failure here is that you don't have Jewish Edim sign it, plus you don't have Erkaot. There's still other Rishonim that say this even applies by Erkaot. If there aren't Jewish Edim signed it, then you're not going to get the kol, because what you want the kol for is the kol for the neighborhood or the people who are interacting with this individual in the Jewish community, and that would require is that there be Edei Chatzimah that are Jewish. V'aminei Reish Lakish mi Rabbi Yochanan. Reish Lakish queries of Rabbi Yochanan. Edim ha-chatumim ala get, ushmotam kishemot ovei kochavim. Mahu. You have Edim ha-chatumim ala get, you have Edim signed on a get, ushmotam. Their names are kishemot ovei kochavim, like non-Jewish names. Mahu. What do we do with this? So from here, the fact that there is no question as to where it came from, it seems to be that the story here is that a get came from Eretz Yisrael, and then the individuals get this get, and the names that are on there are names that look like non-Jewish names. What's the din? Should just know that there are other Rishonim that disagree with Rashi and think that the case here is not exactly what Rashi says about a get going from Eretz Yisrael to Chutz Laaretz. And obviously that has ramifications on the remainder of the sugi as to what the halachic outcome or answer of the Gemara is. Samalei, loba, liadenu, ela locus, velos. We had an incident where these two names showed up on a document. Vechsharnu, and we were matirit. Vedavka locus, velos. And only those names, deloshchichei Yisrael damaske bishmatayu, because Jews don't utilize those names. But other names, Shchicha Yisrael, Damaske Bishmatayu, no. Then it would not be the case. So basically what he answers him is, Shemota Mufchakim. So it's interesting that the question, Rish Lakish asked the question of Rabbi Yochanan, they live in Eretz Yisrael. He's asking him, what happens if a get from Eretz Yisrael ends up in Chutz Laaretz, and they see the signatories to the get, they're non-Jewish names. So he says to them, if they are obviously non-Jewish names, so obvious that no Jew ever goes around with that name, then you don't have to worry about it, and they are Sherim, the get is kasher, because then it's clear that these were not the Edim of the get, and you have Edei Mesira, because everybody knows that non-Jewish Edim are Sulim, and they will not effectuate the get. So that's something that is so obvious. So therefore, if we have obviously non-Jewish signatories to the get, they know that nobody would think a get like this works. So they had to have had Edei Mesira in the picture. Otherwise, they wouldn't be sending a get that has non-Jewish signatories and saying, we have a good get here. So obvious that it would not work that nobody would send a get like that thinking that it was a good get. And if they do send a get like that, it must have been because there were Eidei Mesira involved. Eitve, Reish Lakish challenges Rabbi Yochanan's answer from a Braita, Tosefta. Kitin abayim mimedinat hayam. Kitin that come from overseas. Ve'edim chatumim aleihem. And you have signatories to them. Even though their names are names like Ovdei Kochavim, they are fine, the Gittim. Mipnei, Shirov Yisrael Shebechutz Laretz, Shmoteim Kishemot Ovdei Kochavim. Because the majority of Jewish names overseas, they take on the character of the area where they live, and they start to adopt the names of the places that they live in. And so when you get a get like this, don't assume that these are non-Jews. They are likely Jews. So now you have something that seems to be the exact opposite of Rabbi Yochanan says. Rabbi Yochanan is saying that when they're obviously non-Jewish, then the get is a good get. And over here you have him saying that if they're obviously non-Jewish and no Jew would ever use that name, that wouldn't work. Because the reason it's working here is because these are names, even though they're non-Jewish names, Jews tend to use those non-Jewish names as well. So it seems to be the exact opposite of what Rabbi Yochanan says. Now Rashi says something even more pronounced, which is Rashi says, "Fafilu below Eidei Mesira." This Braita is saying that even without the Eidei Mesira, these are kasher. Or in other words, he's saying that they get here as kasher because of the Eidei Chatima. We're going to rely on the Eidei Chatima over here. And we're going to say they're fine, that they are Jews. And the Eidei Chatima are karte. So now, if we paskin like Rabbi Elazar Bigitin, that Eidei Mesira karte, then why is Rashi over here saying that filo below Eidei Mesira? Rashi, seemingly, and I pointed this out in yesterday's daf as well, is holding like the Rif. That Rabbi Elazar, when he says Eidei Mesira, he means af Eidei Mesira. Eidei Mesira work, and certainly Eidei Chatima work. Not only did Eidei Chatima work, also Eidei Mesira. So over here, where the Eidei Chatima are good, even Rabbi Elazar would agree. Tosfot cannot subscribe to that, because Tosfot believes when Rabbi Elazar says Eidei Mesira, he means exclusively Eidei Mesira, and not Eidei Chatima. So then he says, you see Tosfot in the beginning, he says, Perush, mi amarina di Yisrael ninhu, v'kasher l'Rabbi Meir. Do we say they're Israelim and they are kosher according to Rabbi Meir? Oh, be'edei misira lo Rabbi Lazar, de lo talin anu be'ovdei kochavim. Or do we assume that they were also edei misira? Because we don't assume they were non-Jews. So Tosfot has to explain this Braita differently than Rashi. Rashi simply explains that the Braita is saying that the edei chatima are good, and that's what makes it into a good get. Whether according to Rabbi Meir or whether according to Rabbi Lazar, like the sheet of the Rif. On the other hand, Tosfot says that when Rabbi Lazar says edei misira akarte, he means exclusively edei misira. Eidei Chatima don't work according to Rabbi Lazar. So he explains this brightly, either being that the Eidei Chatima are good according to Rabbi Meir, or the fact that the Eidei Chatima are Jewish means that they also were Eidei Mesira, and that's why it works over here according to Rabbi Elazar. Either way, it's a question on Rabbi Yochanan Shita, who clearly says that only when they're clearly non-Jewish is it an okay get. Here we're saying that it's more likely to be kasher when they are Jewish, or when we think they are Jewish signatories. And the Rabbi Yochanan demands the other way, that when they're non-Jewish signatories, that's the only time that we think that it's kasher. So, Mar says, we answered him, Hatam kedetani taima. Mipnei shirov Yisrael shebechutz laretz, shmoteim kishemot ovdei kochavim. The answer is embedded in what the Tosefta says. When Rabbi Yochanan said his statement, he was saying it in Eretz Yisrael. In Eretz Yisrael, where the robe of the Jewish names are separate from those of the non-Jews, therefore, you have to worry about the fact that maybe they are non-Jews. In Chutz Laretz, who signed on the document, are most likely to be Jews, even if their names look like they're non-Jewish. In Eretz Yisrael, if their names look like they're non-Jewish, you better suspect that they are non-Jewish, and that could be a problem. Unless it's absolutely clear that they're non-Jewish, and then it takes you over the other side, which is that if they're obviously non-Jewish, then everybody knows that it was a problem. But when they have these in-between names, in Eretz Yisrael, it's problematic. So the distinction is between Eretz Yisrael and Medinat Hayam. In Eretz Yisrael, where Jews have separate names completely, then we do worry about it being a non-Jew signing on it. Whereas overseas, where the Jews have non-Jewish names, then we're going to assume, a la Rov, even if it's a non-Jewish name, it probably was a Jew that signed on this document. Now the difference here is so obvious, then what was the question? I mean, obviously here it says, Mibdinat Hayam. The way Rashi is explaining the previous case, it was coming from Eretz Yisrael. What you have to say is that the questioner thought that what the Tosefta says is a general principle, that names, Jewish names, overlap heavily with non-Jewish names. And that should be the same in Eretz Yisrael as in Chutz Laretz. The answer is no, that there is a huge distinction between Eretz Yisrael and Chutz Laretz. Some say, ki matnita b'aminei, that Reish Lakish's question of Rabbi Yochanan was actually the Braita, which was what the Tosefta asked, the case of Gitina b'aminei medinat hayam, and Eim chatumei lehem have names that are Ovdei Kochavim, Upashat Levi Matitan, Rabbi Yochanan answered the Braita. That basically the second answer aligns the cases and said that Rabbi Yochanan is not talking about a separate case. The question was about the case of the Braita, and Rabbi Yochanan quoted the Braita, and that was the answer that he gave to Rish Lakish. And as Tosfos points out here, even according to Rabbi Yochanan, where we suspect that the non-Jewish names in Israel are really non-Jews, that's only when we have a safek about the names. But when we know that they are definitely non-Jewish names, they are kshirim because nobody after the mismachalayu, nobody is going to rely on those names. Nobody's going to rely on those chatimot, and nobody's going to rely on those to be the edei mesira because they're clearly non-Jewish. Omer, ten get zeh liishti, v'shtar shechrur zeh labdi. Person who says, give this document, bill of divorce to my wife. Or give this document of emancipation to my slave. Imrak tzalak zor bishnehem yakzor. If he wants to back out of both of them, he can. Divrei Rabbi Meir. Again, this is the Rabbi Meir we bumped in before, who had says there's a fourth thing where bill of divorce and a document of emancipation are equal. This is the fourth item, which is that you can back out of both of them. Chamimim b'gitei nashim, aval lo b'shechrei abadim. That's true by bills of divorce. That is not true by documents of emancipation. Lefi. And here comes the reason that we discussed before, which is shezachim ladam shelo bifanav, v'chavim lo elo bifanav. It has to do with a principle, which is that you can be zocheh. You can do something to the benefit of a party, even though that party doesn't know you're doing it for them. You can become their, in a sense, agent. I'm using this term loosely because it's not clear that this is how it works. That we'll see in the Tosafot and the Tzotachoshin that deals with this Tosafot, how this works actually functionally, we'll have to discuss. But basically, an individual can go out and represent you, even though you never appointed them as a representative, because they're doing something to your benefit. And of course, you would want them to act on your behalf when they are benefiting you. So if they're going to go win you some big prize, they're going to get you some huge windfall, then of course, you're going to want them to act on your behalf because it's to your favor. On the other hand, if they do something that's detrimental to you, if you never made them your representative, how can they go act to your detriment if you never appointed them to act? And so that's the fundamental reasoning over here. The difference between the Chachamim and Rabbi Meir, therefore, is not about this principle, but rather about, fundamentally, is Gitei Nashim and Shechrei Abadim something good or something bad? And therefore, Rabbi Meir believes that they are both negative, whereas the Chachamim believe that Gitei Nashim, a bill of divorce, is negative, but a document of emancipation is positive. She'im yirtze shelo lazon et abdo. If a person so chooses not to give mizonot to his eved, he can say to him, fend for yourself, and you have to get your own food. Rashai, he can do that. And therefore, when he frees him and gives him a document of emancipation, nothing's changed. Even when he's with them, he can stop giving him mizonot. So when he frees him, he loses mizonot. He could have lost them even if he stayed in position. Shelo lazon et ishto. On the other hand, if a husband decides he doesn't want to give mizonot to his wife, in a rashai, he doesn't have a right to do that. First of all, it's the wife's decision as to whether she wants to take mizonot or not, and it comes with a quid pro quo from her masei yadayim. So he doesn't have a right just to pull the mizonot out from the woman. Therefore, when he divorces her and she loses mizonot, that is something that is detrimental for her. So even though there are instances or cases where you could say it was a schut for the woman to get divorced, or it would be a chovah for the eved to be freed, nevertheless, because ala rov, it is a schut for the eved, and it's a chuvah for the isha. Therefore, we will use that majority or general principle to determine whether it's considered to be a zuchut or chuvah. The Rif suggests, based on the Gemara in Yevamot, that the principle of tav the meitan dum and the meitav armelo, that a woman would always rather be married than not married. And based on that, it's always a schut for the woman, no matter what the situation is, to remain married rather than divorced. Tosafot, based on the Yushalmi, says that the key difference is the ability of the individual to sell his rights to someone else. An eved can be sold against his will to another party. Since the Adon can sell the eved to another party against his will, and the eved has no right of refusal or veto right on that, that tells you that the Adon has such a strong ownership here that his freeing of the eved is a schut to the eved because that gives the eved a certain amount of control back, and since he can be sold baal korcho, then we consider it to be a schut anytime there's freedom to the eved. On the other hand, a husband cannot give over the rights of his wife to someone else. He just has the ability to divorce her, and therefore his, as Tosfot says, any shamit gereshu yedei acher baal korcha. that a woman cannot be divorced by another party against her will, or in essence, the husband can't grant those rights to anyone else. And therefore, since the woman has a certain amount of control over the situation, it's a chuva to her to be divorced rather than a zechut. The Marsha expands on that sheet of the Tosfot and says, it's not about the Baal Korcho and Baal Korcha, but rather what that means in terms of the giving of the document. Since the Eved can be sold against his will, he also can be freed against his will, and that means as soon as the Shliach takes possession of the item, it automatically goes into effect. On the other hand, since a woman cannot be divorced against her will by another party, then even if the Shliach takes it, he cannot then effectuate the divorce until it reaches the woman if it's happening in Baal Korcha. And that's why it's considered to be, quote-unquote, a chova, or there's an inability over here to have the get go effective until it reaches the woman. Sarmalahem, Rabbi Meir responds to them and says, but even by Shechrei Avadim, there's something negative. Arihu poselet abdomen et shuma. If he's a Kohen, and now he gives the Eved freedom, the Eved can no longer eat shuma. Because as long as he was the Eved of the Kohen, he could eat shuma. Now that he's released, he can't eat shuma. Even though, again, the issue of Mizonot, could have lost Mizonot while he was there, but he still could have eaten shuma because he is king and kaspo of the Kohen. Just like the way that his wife loses the right to eat shuma after the divorce. That is what we call a side effect. It is not the primary issue. The reason he can eat shuma is because he's owned by this individual. If he's not owned by the individual, he can't eat shuma. That is not a right of the Eved. That's not something that he has a right to, and then if you free him, he loses that right. It's the whole reason is because the owner owns this individual. It's the owner's ownership that makes that true. And so the owner is owner can take away that ownership. He's the one who really controls that right because it's his ownership that makes that true. It's not a right of the Eved that the Eved can say, hey, I don't want that. I don't want to be freed because I'm going to lose that right. It's not a right. It's just a impact of him being an Eved that is the case. And so therefore you don't see that as a right that he's losing when he gives him a document of freedom.
Yotiv Rav Huna, Rav Yitzchak Bar Yosef, Kamei de Rabbi Yirmiya, V'yotiv Rabbi Yirmiya V'kamei Namnim. So we have an incident here where Rav Huna and Rav Yitzchak Bar Yosef were sitting in front of Rabbi Yirmiya. As Tosfot points out over here, this cannot be the Stam Rav Huna that we find throughout Shas, because that Rav Huna is much older than Rabbi Yirmiya. And therefore this must be a second Rav Huna. Tosafot, in other places in Shas, talks about that issue with regards to the relationship between Rav Chista and Rav Huna and who was older. And therefore Tosafot also makes a similar comment over there that there were two Rav Hunas. And this is not the Stam Rav Huna that we see in Shas. They were sitting in front of Rabbi Yirmiya, and he was dozing off. V'yotiv Rav Huna v'ka'amar. And Rav Huna says, Shmamina, from our Mishnah, you can learn out midrabanan, hatofes the balchov kana. Someone who grabs repayment or collateral on behalf of a creditor, then that person is kone on behalf of the creditor, because he becomes, like what we're seeing in our Mishnah, shliach, and there is zchiya shelo b'fanav. And so over here, just like there is velov zchiya shelo b'fanav in our Mishnah, the same would be true with regards to a Baal Chov. Tosafot already asks over here, v'tei madari. Even if you say that that's true, that a tofes the Baal Chov is kana, what does that have to do with our Mishnah? Our Mishnah has nothing to do with a Baal Chov. In our Mishnah, there's no obligation to free the slave. There is no indebtedness of the Adon towards the slave to have to free him. So how could you compare the case of our Mishnah with regards to a slave and freeing of a slave to this case here, when you're to face the Baal Chov kana? Tosafot really says the question is even the other way around. It's much more likely that you should be able to grab something or benefit a Baal Chov, a creditor, because he has some sort of claim over here. He has some sort of right to what's happening over here. On the other hand, the Eved who holds nothing over his master that should make you into a person who is zoche on his behalf, that can take possession on his behalf or force the master then to free him because somebody else acted on his behalf and did the schia on his behalf. So in the end, the Ri says, "V'nir the Ri, d'choshiv tzad chov, mishum da'avid le'nayach nafshe." The only reason an adon, a master, would free a slave is because the slave must have done something for him. He owes him, he has a good feeling about him, and he feels like he's indebted to him in some way, and that's why he is freeing him. Mikom makom, choshiv le'chav da'chayrim, she'enu chayav lo adon klum. But later on, we're going to see the Gemara says that it's not only that the slave is a Baal Chov, is a creditor, but it's also to the detriment of the Adon. So it's not so much of an obligation on the master to free the slave that we consider it to be a zchut. The whole thing is a zchut, but it sits somewhere in the middle that the slave has some sort of claim to get his freedom because he treated his master well and his master wants to do something good for him. On the other hand, the master has no obligation or direct obligation to free him, and therefore when this person takes possession of it on behalf of the slave, it's to the detriment of the Adon. And so that's how the Tosfot says that these two cases can be equated. Amalei Rav Yitzchak Bar Yosef, afilu makom shechav de acherim. So that's Rav Yitzchak Bar Yosef says back to Rav Huna, you're saying over here that the individual can go on behalf of the creditor and then take possession of some of the debtor's money, possessions, on behalf of this creditor. Is that true even when it's to the detriment of other parties? Because over here, you might have other creditors. And if he goes and takes that, it will be to the detriment of other creditors. Can he take possession of something for this creditor, even though it hurts other creditors over here? Amalei in, Rav Huna says back to him, yes, that it works. Even in the place where it's chayav l'achirim, it's negative or detrimental to other parties, we say it works. Adohochi itarbohu Rabbi Yirmiyah. In the interim, Rabbi Yirmiyah wakes up. Amalehu dardike, youngsters, young ones, hachi amai Rabbi Yochanan. So the discourse that had gone between them, Rabbi Yirmiyah now wakes up and says, listen, some of what you said is right, but some of it is not, and that is a tofes the bachov, but makom shechav de chirim lo kana. He says that when someone takes something for the benefit of a creditor, but to the detriment of other parties, it doesn't work. This idea of schia only works in a case where your zchut for this individual is not a detriment for someone else, because then you can act on behalf of this individual, do something positive to this individual, but not hurt anyone else, then that's fine. But if you're hurting someone else, then that detriment to the other party negates your ability to act on behalf of this party to his benefit. And therefore, atofes debachov makom shechav decherim does not work lo kana. Rashi says over here, as well as in other places in Shas, elabal aso shliach. On the other hand, if the person specifically made him to a shliach, then lizchot bo to do this, then it works. So even though generally we say atofes the baal chov makom shechav decherim lo kana, it doesn't work. But if there is directed shlichut and agency over here, meaning that the adon or the creditor assigned this individual to be his agent, then they can act on his behalf, even to the detriment of other parties. Tosafot questions that, and he says that that is absolutely wrong. And Rashi is wrong over here. It's not like what Rashi says in Bab Mitzia, that the kuliyama, when you make a shliach, it's kana. Dein chiluk. There's no difference here between whether the person acts on behalf of you knowingly, meaning you made him into an agent, whether he acts without your knowledge. Because, dafilu laso shliach, shluchahu deschia mitam shlichot. The whole reason that this works when a person does schia on your behalf is because he is basically anansade, that he becomes a shliach. We basically look at this and say he wants you to be an agent. So your agency is engaged simply because that's what we know he would want here. And therefore you become a shliach. So if zchia fails, that means that shlichut fails. And if shlichut fails, that doesn't matter whether you made him an agent or he became an agent, because we assume that that must be the case. You must want him to be an agent. And therefore, Tosafot says that even if he pointed him as an agent, he cannot act on behalf of the Baal, where it's to the detriment of other parties. If you look in the Ktzot HaChoshen and Choshen Mishpat, Siman Kufay, Seif Aleph, over there, the Ktzot HaChoshen says that I'm not sure that Tosafot is so right over here. And he brings proofs from the Sugya of Yehi Shalom Idat in Boba Metzia that shows you that that's not the case. The way that Shlichut works and the way that Zechia works are through different methods. And therefore, the Ktzot HaChoshen says that Zchia works mishum yad and not mishum shlichut. It works as an individual being an extension of you and not because he becomes your agent or emissary. And therefore, the dinim will be completely different. Even though something might be true when he becomes your yad, it may not be true when you have actual shlichut or actual agency. And therefore, just because it fails over here by schia doesn't mean it will fail by shlichut or directedly shlichut. And in defense of Rashi, he says that Tosafot's assumption that schia is mishum shlichut is incorrect. And schia is really mishum yad, which means it's as if you've extended the hand of that party. You become as if you are the hand of that party when you act on his behalf. So then the Ktzot HaChoshen says, and even according to those Rishonim that say that it is mishum shlichut, He doesn't think it's what Tosavot says, that it's a din of Anan Sadeh, that it's a din of Shlichut, real type of Shlichut, which comes from Anan Sadeh, that we see that he would want this, and therefore he automatically becomes a Shliach, but rather Mishum Gzeret HaKatuv. It is a Gzeret HaKatuv that Shlichut can work in this case, or that someone can act on your behalf. So, the Ksot HaChoshen says, therefore, there are two ways to view this. One is to say that Zchiyah, in these cases, is Mishum Shlichut, the way that Tosfot does. He disagrees fundamentally with how Tosfot views that, but it's not Shlichut Mishum Anan Sadeh that we would assume that that would be the case, but rather because the Torah says that a person can be a Shliach in this case from the Psukim by Kiddushin. On the other hand, he says there are a whole slew of Rishonim, including Rashi, who think that Zchiyah is Mishum Yad. It begins to become the hand of the individual because it's to his benefit, and therefore you become as if you're an extension of his hand and acting on his behalf. And therefore, that's why Rashi says over here, if he makes him a shliach, an agent, it does not have the same din as zchiyah. Zchiyah and agency are working in two different realms. And just because it doesn't work by zchiyah does not mean that it does not work by shlichut or by agency. And he says, the nafka mina will be whether a goy can act on your behalf. A goy is not shayach to the world of shlichut, and therefore a goy can't be zocheh on behalf of an individual. On the other hand, a goy is shayach to the world of yad, or being an extension of the individual himself, and therefore a nachri could be zocheh on behalf of Israel if the din of zchiyah is mishum yad. He says that's one nafkamina, the other nafkamina being what Rashi and Tosafot are arguing about over here. If you assign an agent, then have it work, despite the fact that in zchiyah it doesn't work. Tosafot says no, zchiyah is mishum shlichut, doesn't work there, it's certainly not going to work when you appoint an agent. But then Rashi says, no, zchiyah mishum yad. And therefore, even if it doesn't work there, you might be able to get it to work when you appoint an agent directly to do your shlichut. And that's what Rashi says over here, as well as in the Gemara in Baba Metzia.
V'im tomar mishnateinu. What about our Mishnah? Our Mishnah is a case of a tofes the bachov b'makom shechav ve'acherim. And over there, it says that it works. So how come it works over there? Mar says, kol omer tnu komer zechudami. Anytime you use the language of tnu, it's as if you're telling the shliach to take possession of it on behalf of the other party. So it's not simply that they're doing a shchiyah, acting on behalf of the recipient, but even the giver or the grantor here is telling the shliach to accept it on behalf of that other party. And since that's the case, even the granting party here has the intent for this to go through. Tosafot over here discusses the problem that the word tnu or tain, according to Rabbi Yochanan and other Moraim, does not work. It's not the equivalent of saying zechu, take possession of it. And therefore, Tosafot has to work out over here how this statement of tain get zelishti, star shechu zel abdi, is actually engaging the other party to be zochet on behalf of the recipient, because the word tain doesn't function that way. So Tosafot brings two possibilities. V'teres Rabbeinu Tam, the dafka deheicha dadat acheret makneuto, arminin ten kizchi, that ten kizchi works when you have two parties involved, when there's a granting party and a recipient, then ten has the possibility of acting like acting as if you said liskot b'zeh. By the mitziah, when you have an aveda that you're finding, there's no other party that's granting the ownership over to you. And in that case, the word ten doesn't have the meaning of being zocheh on behalf of other parties. In addition, the Reino Tam brings the possibility that there's a difference between matanot and halvaot, and that only by matanot do we say that the word tnu does not mean liskot, but rather lahalech, take it to them. On the other hand, when it comes to halvaot or hitchayvut, in that case, tnu means zchu on behalf of the other party. And that's how they solve the problem of this inconsistency as to whether the word tain or tnu means liskot, telling the other party of the shliach to take it on behalf of them, or whether it only means go and do this, act on my behalf, but the action won't be completed until it reaches this recipient. So those of us brings the two possibilities as to how to differentiate. Either because it's either only true when you have a grantor and a recipient that tnu works kizliskot, but in cases of mitziah and other cases where there's no grantor, it would not work. Or he says there's a difference between cases of matana and cases of halva'a. And that by matana, it does not work. Whereas by shichrur or balei chov, it does work. So Amar Rav Chista, hatufes the balchov b'makom shlecha v'cherim, banu l'machloket Rabbi Eliezer v'rabanan. When you are tofes for a balchov in the place where it's to the detriment of another party, that's the machloket of Rabbi Eliezer and the Chachamim, Ditanan. We have a Mishnah. Mi shliketet apeyah, someone who goes to collect peyah, someone who is not ra'oi or permitted to collect peyah,
Peyaz, the corner of the field that must be left over. And this person who is not an ani is not permitted to pick up peyah. Vamar, harizu the ploni ani. He goes into the field and collects on behalf of a poor person. So he's not collecting for himself. He's collecting on behalf of someone who is entitled to collect over here. Is he allowed to do that? So Rabbi Eliezer amar zachalo. Rabbi Eliezer says he can do it. It works. V'chachamim amrim, it's netu l'ani, anim sarishom. He has to drop it and give it to the first ani he bumps into. What Rav Chisda says is this is exactly our case. When this rich, quote-unquote, individual goes in and collects on behalf of the ani, he is doing that to the benefit of that one poor person, but to the detriment of other poor people. Other poor people who would have come and collected, it's to their detriment that he's taking on behalf of this ani. And then we see there's a machlok between Rav Elazar and the Chachamim as to whether it works or not. And that seemingly means that it's a machlok as to whether a person is to face the bachol b'makom shechav d'cherim. Does it work or does it not work? Now, whether this is limited to a third party, or whether the Baal, the owner of the field, could also do this, is a machlok between Rashi here and Rashi in Baba Metzia. Rashi over here says it can even be the Baal HaSadeh that collects over here. Whereas in Baba Metzia, he says it has to be a third party. That will have to do with, we'll see in a second, the conclusion of the Gemara as to how this works, and there will indicate how Rashi would learn it. So Amar Meimar, Vimitemar of Papa, Dilmalohi. Who says that that's the machloket here between Rabbi Lezer and the Chachamim? Ad kono kamar Rabbi Lezer otam el demigo di bayim afker lehu nanichsei babi ani. There's a migo that if he wants to dispossess himself of all of his possessions and turn into an ani, v'chazile, and therefore he'd be ra'uy to collect the pay over here. Umiga de zachile de nafshei, zachile chavrei. And since he can collect on his own behalf, therefore he can collect on behalf of someone else. So maybe Rabbi Eliezer's reasoning is not because of Tufes Bachov Shmakom Shechav D'Acherim that works and is koneh, and that's why it works over here, but rather there's a migo. It's not because Tufes Bachov Shmakom Shechav D'Acherim that works, but rather because of the migo. Since you have the ability to collect yourself this payah, therefore you can also collect on behalf of this other individual. And what you're going to have to say for Rashi in this instance is the same thing. This Baal, if you're the owner of the Sadeh over here, just like you can collect for the ani in another field, even though in this field, technically you can't collect because it belongs to you, but migo that you can collect in another field. Plus, since you could dispossess yourself of all your possessions, therefore you can collect on behalf of the ani. And you would have to use two migos to do that. And that might be the machlok in the Rashi. Rashi in Baba Metzia says, only one migo. If you own the field, you are precluded from taking anything in that field. On the other hand, Rashi here says you could invoke these two migos. If that's the case, even the Baal HaSadeh could collect on behalf of the ani. Aval Hocha, in our case here in the Mishnah, or in the case of HaTofes the Bachob, Makom Shechav D'Acherim, lo, then Rabbi Lezer would say that it doesn't work. And though Tosva points out that this Dilma Lohi is just a Dechuya Ba'alma to say that you can't prove anything from there, but in Achanami, Rav Papa himself believes that HaTofes the Bachob, Makom Shechav D'Acherim is Lo Kana. And he believes that that is the right psak over here. But he doesn't see that as being mukhrach from the machlok between Rabbi Lezer and the Chachamim. And the same can be true the other way around. Ba'ad kan lo kami rabbonan hotam elo dichtiv. Maybe there the rabbonan say that you cannot collect on behalf of the ani because it says, lo tilakeit le'ani. The pasuk never says that. The Gemara is reparsing the pasuk. Ubekur tzichem et ketzir atzichem. Lo tichalef atzadcha bekutzrecha. Beleket tzircha lo tilakeit. Then there's a stop. There's an etnachta. What the Gemara does is runs through the etnachta and says, lo tilakeit le'ani. You may not collect on behalf of the ani. And basically it becomes a gzerat hakatuv. Lo tilakeit lo le'ani. That you're not allowed to collect on behalf of the ani. Aval hacha, but maybe here by a tofes t'bachov makom shechav d'acherim, the Chachami would agree that it works and you can be koneh because it's a gzerat hakatuv over there. Rabbi Eliezer, hi, lo tilakeit mayav delay. What does Rabbi Eliezer do with that limud that the Chachamim have by lo tekalakeit l'ani? Mibayle l'hazir l'ani al shalom. It's to tell you that the ani may not take his own payah. Since he is the owner of the field, he may not take it, and he has to leave payah, he has to leave a corner over for other aniim to take. And that's the hazara here, lo tekalakeit l'ani. Even the ani himself may not take it. So Tosafot over here makes two comments about the limud of the Chachamim. One of which is, there is an opinion, a machloket in the Gemara in Temura, that if you do something the Torah says you can't do, whether you have an efficacious action. And there is a day there that even though the Torah says don't do it, if you do it, it works. So over here, if he goes and collects it, even though the Torah said don't collect it, maybe it should work. So So Tosfot says, no, here there is a gzeret ha-ketuv that says, laniv la-ger tazov otam, that you must leave them and not make a kinyan. So not only are you not allowed to do it, but it doesn't work because there's no form of kinyan here. It must be tazov otam. It must be left there. In addition, Tosafot says, why don't we learn from here that if you pick up something on behalf of someone else, that it doesn't work. So Tosfot says that maybe again here it's gzeret ha-ketuv, which is that the Torah only granted the right for someone to pick this up for someone who needs it for themselves. And that's the gzeret ha-ketuv that surrounds leket, shechicha, and peyah, is that naniv ha-ger tazov otam, that only those individuals who have a right to collect can then go collect. That way, it disengages the possibility, or discards the possibility of anybody else coming and acting on their behalf. And so from here, you can't use this as a paradigm for other cases because it is a gzeret ha-ketuv. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Yud Bet Amud Aleph.